What's up, everyone, and welcome to the Elevate Experience,
the podcast about overcoming struggles and adversity and how that relates to addiction, recovery, and health. I am your host and the CEO of Elevate Addiction Services, Angie Manson.
And I'm Dallas Terrell, co-host and life intervention counselor at Elevate. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's jump right in.
Welcome to the show, guys. Today is a little different. You know, we usually have special guests, and in fact, we do have a very special guest today, but it's actually our co-host, Dallas Terrell.
Yeah, here I am, the special guest and co-host all at the same time. I don't know how I feel about it.
It's
feels different.
It is new. It is different. It's awkward and uncomfortable, but you know, I realized after we've recorded about 15 deep that wait a minute, we haven't even talked about ourselves, and I'm sure that was by design because neither one of us love talking about ourselves or our stories.
Very true.
But at the same time, it's kind of like if you're listening to the show, you want to know who is talking to all these people and why and what gives us the either authority or desire to want to do what we're doing. And so it's about time we bring it back around to us, Dal.
It is, Ange. And we've made it. We've made it. And I was thinking about it last night. I was like, damn. It's weird to talk about yourself or your life, and you know, I think you kind of hit on it too. Like it's just a strange feeling. And even though I do it in like private, I give a lot of examples like from my life to clients and things like that. It's a little bit different, you know. Not sure why, but it is.
Well, I think also it's just the modality that we've gotten sober on. It's mm-hmm. not part of the normal habit for us to rehash or go over our using history or our prior history. It's always been that's something that we've done in private or with a counselor. And our goal, especially as staff, is to help others and listen to their story and not make it about us but them. And so we've been sort of trained in a totally different way in our sobriety, so it is new and different.
Yeah, I think it's a great point too, because I forget where I heard it from, but like what makes a good counselor is having like the ability to listen, having the ability to relate, but not, it's not necessarily like I did it this way so you need to do it this way. So even though I do use certain pieces of my life as like an example or as motivation or a hope, it's not like my go-to when I'm in a counseling session or when I'm working with a client. I spend a lot more time being curious about them and what's going on with them. And I try to like leave myself out of it, because at the end of the day, none of it is about me. So I think that's kind of where the, I guess, I don't know what the word is, but that's where the like discomfort comes from, is making it all about me just feels wrong, I guess, you know?
Yeah, it's different for us.
But we're going to give it a try. Yeah. We're going to give it a whirl.
Yeah, you know, I've been out and about lately, and I keep hearing the mantra over and over is we've got to own our stories. And mm-hmm. not that we haven't owned our stories. I think we're both totally fine openly communicating about anything that's happened in our lives.
Very true.
But it's more sharing those stories so that others can either get information, inspiration, ideas, or motivation. I think that's the goal.
Yeah, and even if it just helps one person, then it's worth it. You know, this discomfort I'm sitting with right now is worth it.
Well, thank you. And thank you for going first. That way I can get you through it and then you can get me through it.
Yeah, for the audience, Angie is next after me. So I'm very excited to interview her as well, because that'll feel way better. And I think just another side note too, before we even get started, is this isn't like our, we're not about to talk about like our highlight reel. We're about to discuss kind of like our low light reel. So maybe that's why it feels the way it feels too, is because it's not like the things I go to bed and just hype myself up about, like, yeah, you were such a piece of shit, right on, you know, like it's, so it's, some of it's pretty negative and painful. So
true. And part of, again, our program, it's mm-hmm. about, you know, mindfulness and being in the present. So it's not like we even think about our past so often, because we are so focused on staying in the present. So,
yeah, and making things better for the future.
Absolutely. So again, it's just an unfamiliar place for us.
Yes, I agree, Ange. With that being said,
where do we want to go? How far back you want to go, Dal? You know, you were a child.
I was a child at one point.
You had a normal upbringing, but your father was in recovery.
He was. Yeah, my dad has been sober coming up on 35 years. I'm 28, so I've never seen him drink a day in my life. But yeah, I think, so I grew up with a dad that doesn't drink, and sobriety, like, being a thing, but when you're young, you don't really know, like, what that really is. But I remember being, like, 10 or 11 and 12, like, that kind of starting to grow up age, and, you know, we'd be at dinner, and my dad would just make it known if we ever put alcohol in his drink as, like, a prank or a joke, that he'd ruin us. That was his wordage. Yeah. And it was always like, why the hell would I put like mom's tequila in your water? Like, why would we ever do that? You know? So it
sparked some curiosity because you didn't even understand why he was so serious about this.
For sure. Yeah. And so my parents were separated. So I have a mom, a dad, a stepdad, and a stepmom. And, stepdad and mom drink like normal people, and my stepmom drinks like a normal person, but my dad doesn't. So it was kind of different perspectives growing up, and you had a blended family. And yeah, so I guess, let's see here. So,
well, when did you start chipping or experimenting? Let's talk about that. Like, what was the first push in that direction?
So the first push in that direction was probably like going into high school, kind of just having a beer with a friend. And I think my mom gave me my first beer, honestly, kind of under the guise of the umbrella that, like, at least he's doing it here, or if someone's gonna, he's gonna have a beer anyways, like, it might as well be like
safe and responsible.
Exactly. So that's confusing as a kid, like your dad saying don't ever drink and your mom saying here, have a beer. You're right. Like, mom's pretty cool, you know?
She's a cool parent.
Yeah. So during high school, I mean, my dad was the best too, you know, but as I started experimenting, mom became a lot cooler. But yeah, so high school, I think, is where it all started and where it all ended, honestly, for me. So played sports my whole life, baseball. And
you're super athletic. I mean, still today,
very to this athletic. Day, sports and, you know, activities like working out and stuff like that were a big part of my life, and never had issues in school, like homework wise or anything like that. So yeah, so in high school, I would say around sophomore year, I probably started to like be the weekend, like, let's go party guy. But everyone else was too. So it didn't feel like too out of place or anything like that. And, you know, on a Saturday, you go to a high school party and drink some beers and come home, and that was it. And probably did that for like a year. And the pot kind of started showing up too a little bit. Not all the time, because I also couldn't drink or smoke pot at my dad's house. So it was always like every other weekend I'd be at my mom's house. So every other weekend I'd smoke pot or something, you know. And so it was very like in control and moderation. I was doing good in school and playing sports and working out. And that's where all my focus was on. So we'll fast forward. Junior year, I had a stepbrother, and he was kind of more of a wild card. He was starting to kind of fall into the wrong crowd. And he went to, I think, like, he went to Wyoming and did this, like, boys program.
Like a wilderness.
Wilderness thing for, like, a year, because he got caught smoking weed in, like, eighth grade.
Wow.
Right, so he got in trouble early. So he kind of already had that, like, I don't want to say, like, bad boy mentality. But he really had, like, I didn't give a shit attitude. So he influenced me, because I'd be at my dad's house part-time, so I was only around him part-time. But when I was around him, he'd be like, oh man, last weekend I did ecstasy, or last weekend I did Xanax, or last weekend I tried cocaine. And so that was funny. So junior year, his goal was to try every drug that was
out there.
That was his goal.
Wow.
Like his scholarly goal for the year. And he achieved it.
Oh man.
So just kind of by coincidence, like, you know, because I was at my dad's and my stepmom's half the time, and my mom and my stepdad's half the time. So if I just happened to be there at the half of the time that he was there, and he just happened to be, we were suite mates, like our rooms were right next to each other. And, you know, some days he'd have Oxycontin, some days he'd have oxycodone or coke or ecstasy or hash or heroin even sometimes. So I started to live like vicariously through him.
And when you say vicariously, is just watching him, or you were experimenting too?
So I would smoke weed with him, but that was pretty much it. But he'd have buddies over that were like doing these like harder drugs, if you will. And I always had like an obligation, like, oh, I would love to try the cocaine with you guys, because I really would have, but I got baseball practice in an hour, or I have school, or I'm hanging out with my girlfriend, which was like a blessing. I had these like obligations keeping me away from the BS.
Yeah.
Those obligations eventually fell away. I think junior year I tried ecstasy and I tried Xanax, but still controlled. You know, it was like a one-off thing. So we'll fast forward to senior year of high school. I switched to a different high school to play baseball, a better school.
That's a tough transition though, senior year where you know, you're supposed to be the top dog of the school you've been at this whole time, and now mm-hmm. you're going in blind to a brand new school where you know nobody.
Yeah, exactly. And so the only person I knew was my stepbrother, who was not doing very well. You know, we would carpool to school, and at the time I was on like ADHD medication, so before school I would smoke weed and take my Adderall. So I was already like kind of messed up going into school. And then he eventually, since I live with my dad now full time, because that's where the school district was, I was around him a lot more. And we were just negative influences for each other. We'd skip school early and go do, it started with cocaine. We found this guy named Joe Blow, and that was his name. And we
ironic.
Yeah, ironic. So we started doing cocaine, and then we started doing Xanax, and then we started doing, you know, just, but for me, it was still like a weekend thing. You know, I still had baseball practice every day and baseball games and scrimmages and a girlfriend, and I still had to work out. So I literally was like held to a higher standard where I couldn't just get as fucked up as he did all the time. Thanksgiving, senior year, I think my girlfriend like cheated on me or something like that. I was super depressed. It was like I got caught at the perfect moment where I was at my dad's house. DJ was doing heroin in the room right next to me. And was like, dude, I know you're sad. Like, you should just do this with me. And that's when I smoked heroin for the first time. And yeah, it kind of just was like this weekend thing. It became this weekend thing where I'd do heroin with him. And we'd smoke it. And
that's a hard weekend drug because it's so addicting.
Yeah.
Physically, mentally.
And it's weird because it didn't start that way. Like, it kind of just felt like a hangover, like the next morning. It was kind of like alcohol to me, where I could just get screwed up in the next morning, go to school and play baseball, and it didn't like mess with me that much. I don't know why, but it didn't.
Probably because you weren't doing it every day, so it wasn't building that physical dependency quite yet.
Exactly. And he was developing that physical dependency, and I was starting to kind of notice, and I was very naive. Like, I just kind of went from drinking and smoking pot on the weekends to like smoking heroin on the weekends. We all kind of know how that story goes. Senior year of high school, we're at tryouts, already on the team. You know, I'm like looking to get like scouted for baseball and pitching and everything like that. And I was in tryouts, and I hit a double like in baseball down the line, and somehow my shoulder blew out of my socket from swinging the bat, like on the follow through. And so now my shoulder was all messed up. I couldn't play baseball senior year. So I spent more time smoking heroin now, because I had no obligations. I didn't have to go to practice every day. I didn't have to do anything. I just had school, which ended at 11:30. So I just started doing heroin every day. And that was kind of that. Barely graduated high school. I was fully addicted to heroin by the end of senior year of high school.
Wow.
And my dad's sober, and they started kind of picking up on like, dude, our boys are messed up. Like, we're starting to miss money. They're starting to like not be where they said they were. Dallas isn't going to baseball practice. Dallas isn't working out. Dallas is fighting with his girlfriend. My mom's starting to know kind of the same thing. Now they're both talking, saying, hey, I'm seeing this. Are you seeing this? And
well, and probably not seeing you for like a little bit at a time and then seeing you again, you kind of notice a shift since the last time you saw him, as opposed to the people who see you every day where it's so subtle that you maybe don't catch those indicators.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And so we ended up kind of like going down a dark path, me and my stepbrother. I barely graduate high school, graduate fully addicted to drugs. But the plan, my mom's plan was always, once you graduate high school, we're going to move up to Park City, Utah. So by the time that even came up, it was like, I got kicked out of my dad's house. I couldn't even live in Arizona. I was forced to go to Park City, Utah with my mom. because I couldn't live in Arizona. I had nowhere else to stay. And so I figured, okay, cool. I'd get cleaned up, start over fresh, move to Park City, don't know anybody. I'm like trying to find a job. I'm trying to get into college. I'm trying to find people to sell me weed because I don't know anybody.
Did you have to detox yourself through that process?
Not really, because it was still like the addicted to heroin then was not how you would see it now.
Like not like a junkie.
Right. Like it was like I didn't have a job. I would just get it when I could. I'd probably do it like 3-4 times a week. That was it, you know, but I'd still jones for it. And I still felt like crap when I didn't have it, but I wasn't like shooting heroin 4, 5, 6 times a day for years at a time.
Yeah.
So, and I was still doing other drugs too and stuff and partying and smoking pot. It was just, I was partying, but heroin was in the mix a lot.
Yeah.
Move up to Park City, find a job, start working at PacSun, go to college. I'm like, dude, life's like pretty good. I found one person to sell me weed. Didn't know anybody. The beer was 3% alcohol. You could drink a whole 30 pack and not even get drunk because it was Utah beer. And I'm like, okay, I don't know anybody. I'm spending a lot of time at the skate park. That's actually where I met someone to sell me weed. And life was going good. I'm a month into college and I find out that something happened where I wasn't like in-state tuition because I was out of state. Mm-hmm. So my mom was like, dude, I'm not going to pay like 10 grand for you to go to community college. Like, let's just take the year off. Once you're considered a resident, you can go back to college. Never went back to college.
Oh, man.
Eventually found someone that had, I think it took like 9 to 10 months until I found heroin in Utah. And then it was off to the races. And the first treatment center I went to was Cirque Lodge in Utah. They had like a discount program if you were a resident. And so I went to Cirque Lodge for 30 days and... By that time, I was shooting heroin, smoking crack, selling Xanax, selling weed. I got an intervention at my house and go to detox at a hospital. And then it was kind of weird because I got like recruited in the hospital. Like you'd be in this hospital ward with all these other people detoxing. And then the guy from Cirque Lodge was like, hey, you need cigarettes? Like you want me to order you guys a pizza or something? And like totally conned me into his rehab, which was like, I guess, cool. You know, I needed the help for sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure that stuff would fly these days.
No. So there's this dude buying me cigarettes, buying me pizza the whole time I'm detoxing to like solidify that I go to Cirque Lodge.
And how old were you when
I was 19?
First rehab. Okay.
I was 19. I was young, like a year out of college or high school, maybe a year and a half, and fully addicted though. Like I skipped a lot of stuff as far as like that whole year of using. I was using drugs.
Yeah, you know. I'm sure there was destruction. The standard and destruction, and criminality, yep. And everything that
all
goes
of that
with
was
that.
There. All of that was there. Fighting violence, selling drugs, avoiding cops. All that was there.
Did you get any charges? Was there any like record?
I
built?
Did, but for like smoking weed, I got my license taken away in Utah for like drinking and smoking, and but I never got caught for like selling drugs or heroin or anything like that. I go to Cirque Lodge for a month. First experience in treatment, had no idea what to expect. Super cool place. They had a gym. I got really into fitness there again. Let's see, my first time like with a therapist and doing groups and having a counselor and working the steps and going to meetings and meeting people that are sober. And it was a cool experience. I just had nothing to go off of. So I just thought that's how you get sober. You go to meetings, you get a sponsor, you work the steps. I think I worked like three or four of the steps. After I graduated, I had a month sober. I went to the guy that did my intervention. He had a sober living called the Sky House in Utah. So I went to stay with him. He like recruited me out of the rehab. Now that I look back at it, it was kind of like he was picking and choosing people to bring to his sober living.
Wow. They had quite the little system.
Yeah.
Continuing care over there.
They did. Yeah. And so he plucked me up out of there, picked me up on my graduation date. And, you know, I got to pick up some groceries and meet the guys at the house. And it was cool. They'd drive me to work. And every weekend they had an experiential guy that worked there. So one guy would come in for the weekend. He'd take us rock climbing. He'd take us mountain biking. And we'd go do shit, which was super cool. And I think that lasted.
Adventure therapy stuff.
Adventure therapy. I love that. Yeah. He was pretty cool. Just, he's the only guy, he was a mountaineer. He was the only guy to ever ski down K2, which is like in the Himalayas.
Oh, wow.
And not die.
Wow.
The disclaimer is he broke his neck and almost died.
Oh my God.
So he's like the only guy to ski it and not die, but he almost died. Super crazy guy. So he's driving us around meetings and I'm having fun and we're smoking cigarettes and drinking Monsters and listening to, like, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd and rolling up to meetings and stuff and having fun. And I think I had like 3 months sobriety there. And then I started smoking pot. We started kind of like sneaking pot in. I started going to my mom's house and like sneaking a beer. And then I stole my sister's like fentanyl patch. And it just kind of, that's how the ball started going there. Let's see. So then I was working at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. And let's see here.
I love that steak.
Ruth's Chris. Yeah, Ruth's Chris Steakhouse was the best. So my sister got me a job there. I was working there. I got kicked out of the sober living for using. And then, so now I had nowhere to go, but I had some money. So I got my own apartment in town in Park City. And I was like trying to stay sober, but not doing anything to keep my sobriety.
You weren't going to meetings. You weren't hanging around anything. Sober people. Yeah.
Nothing.
Were you working out?
Not even working out.
Yeah.
I was just working and I had this great idea to start selling weed to like supplement my income, but like not smoke it. So I'm in my apartment selling weed, working at Ruth's Chris. And, you know, then I started getting sketchy people coming over to my house and they're like, hey, do you know where to get cocaine? And do you know where to get mushrooms or acid or pills or this or that?
At that point, you're already dealing pot. So
for sure. And I was already kind of known for that in the city prior to my first treatment center. So I just basically invited all the scumbags back into my life.
Park City's pretty small too, right?
Pretty small town, yeah, like 8,000 people.
Yeah.
So that whole thing started going on again, and now I'm selling pot to the guys I met in treatment who are starting to slowly fall off the map. And my apartment turned into a trap house. And I think I lasted in that apartment, Ruth's Chris, selling drugs situation for probably like 9 to 10 months. It didn't last very long. I would say 2 months into that apartment, I was shooting heroin and selling crack and drugs and everything out of my house for the next 7 months.
I'm surprised you lasted that long without getting busted.
Yeah. Somehow never got busted. So the thing that prompted my next treatment center, which was in Salt Lake, it's called Recovery Ways, was I woke up one morning and the girl I was seeing was like going through my phone and saw a bunch of text messages and I was like, I'm leaving you, blah, blah, blah. You're a piece of shit. And it's like, no, don't go, you know, type of thing. But it happened at 6 a.m. And so when you wake up in the morning, you're sober, kind of. So I was a little bit more clear-headed. Right. This girl just left me. So who do I call? My mom. Mm. And I'm like, Mom, this girl just broke up with me, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, well, probably because you're like kind of a piece of shit. Like, you should go back to rehab, probably. And I was like, good point. So that day I went to another hospital to detox and from there went to Recovery Ways, Utah, or Recovery Ways in Utah. I was there for another month and while I was there, they had like sober softball, sober volleyball, and they had a really cool experiential program too. They'd take us kayaking and fishing and rope climbing and we do a bunch of cool shit. And for me, that's what recovery kind of was, like going to meetings and doing cool shit.
Yep.
Like, I liked that. Like, that, I was young. At this point, I was still 20 years old now.
Yeah. Sober fun.
For sure. I didn't know anybody sober, and I did their program for 30 days and was super happy. I went to another sober living after. Started seeing this girl, and she was abusing her gabapentin, and she was taking so much anti-seizure gabapentin that it was giving her seizures. So then she went to the hospital and got a bunch of Ativan, which is a benzo, for her seizures. And then so now she was taking benzos, and then so she fell off the wagon. And I was so upset that my girlfriend relapsed that I was like, I'm gonna come down there and save you. I ended up relapsing.
One reason for relapse.
Yeah. Yeah. Girls is a very common theme in my like recovery downfalls.
Yep.
For sure. Anyway, so me and this chick start running amok in Salt Lake City. I go to detox. She gets extracted from Salt Lake and moves back to New York, but we're still dating. I go to detox and I'm like, Mom, I want to go be with my girlfriend in New York. I go live with her in New York.
Wow.
Rochester, New York. And we're both immediately using drugs and heroin and crack and cocaine. And I think I lived there for like 4 months. And then she got extracted by her dad. Like one day I got back from work and her dad was just like forcing her to leave. Because I was just this like young, shitty person ruining his daughter's life, which was not very far from the truth.
But that happens when you have two addicts together.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very...
It was totally mutual. I was the same
way with my best friend. It wasn't a boyfriend, but we were just like the worst for each other.
And she didn't want to go. She kind of had to. We were running out of money. And
yeah.
So weird thing, July 4th of that year, I think it was 2011 or 12 maybe, I had no money, but I was living in a furnished apartment. And I went to the hood of, in New York, the projects, and I told these guys I had a bunch of furniture for sale if they wanted it. And so these dudes come over to my house and they sell me drugs for all the furniture in the furnished apartment that's not mine.
Oh.
So I empty out this apartment of furniture and flat screens and desks. They took everything, the microwave, the fridge, end tables, the rugs.
Fridge.
Everything. Oh, yeah. Man. And so the reason that's important is because then I had all this money and all these drugs and was just like living in this like unconscious state of mind.
In New York still?
In New York City.
Wow.
Or not New York City, in New York State, Rochester, New York. And one day I show up and I was dodging the landlord because she was like, they're probably getting calls about this sketchy dude and whatever. And I show up and the locks are changed and all my stuff's in there. All my prescriptions, all my clothes, all my everything. And now I'm locked out of this house. And I think I was like, it was like the same day I was like almost out of money and drugs too. So now I'm homeless, literally locked out of my own place. I already traded in my phone at that time too. Oh, yeah. So the only access I had to anybody was the public library at 30 minutes at a time. And I was sleeping in like a mission. So some homeless dude, I was like drinking 40s with the homeless dudes at the park, and they were giving me food and beer because I had no money, and
wow,
giving me kind of like the homeless lay of the land, like, oh yeah, we all sleep under the we all sleep in the police parking garage because they'd rather have us there than out on the streets.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So I was like, oh okay, cool. You know,
is it true in real life, did you have paper bags over your 40s?
Yeah. You okay. Have to, yeah. In New York, yeah, you can't have open containers. You got to have the paper bag.
Perfect.
And anyway, so I'm like homeless for probably like 3 or 4 weeks, like literally sleeping on a cardboard box in Rochester, New York with no phone. And I was waiting for my last paycheck from the job that I had. They fired me because I was stealing everybody's money and stuff from the back room where they all the girls kept their purses and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm waiting to get my last check, and I knew the date of getting my last check, and I was sleeping at this mission. It was called the Open Door Mission. You had to be there by 5 at night. If you've ever seen the movie The Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith, have you ever seen that movie?
I've not seen that one.
He's in San Francisco, and he's like sleeping at these missions.
Oh, wow.
You have to be in line at 5, and they have a cutoff. So you have to get there to be accepted in there, and once you're in there, you can't leave. Mm. And then you got to leave by 6 a.m. And they would give me like a Ziploc bag full of scrambled eggs and say, don't come back till 5. And that was like my life for like 3-4 weeks until I finally got my last paycheck. I like panhandled for $1 to get my last paycheck, got my last paycheck, bought drugs and a plane ticket back home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Fly back home to Salt Lake City, still on drugs. My mom's like, what the hell are you doing, dude? Like, you look terrible. And I was messaging her on Facebook a little bit too. Like, hey, I need to leave New York. I'm going to die out here. Because that's how it felt. And go back to Salt Lake City. Start doing the same crap again.
Living at her house.
Living at her house. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then so now, usually I fast forward through all of this because it just sounds like a parrot. I go back to Salt Lake City. They're like, you're on drugs. You can't be here. So then I go to detox in Salt Lake City. I went to detox every week for that whole summer because I had nothing else to do. I had nowhere else to go. I would use my insurance card. I'd go to detox and I'd leave. I'd use for a week, run out of moves and money, go back to the detox, and they'd pump you up on Ativan and Suboxone and snacks for a week. and then you regroup.
Yeah.
So finally, at the end of the summer, I'm like, dude, I'm using my insurance to go to rehab. Like, this is bullshit. This sucks. Like, I hate my life. So I go to rehab in Laguna Beach called Spencer's Recovery Center. I was there for 2 weeks before I got kicked out for stealing somebody's credit card and stealing money and using. And then so they're like, hey, you can go to our sister treatment center in Florida. So then I flew out to Florida and I was there for like a month, met another girl, and then me and her were running amok in Florida.
Uh-oh, yep.
And she was rich. She was like 30 years old and had a husband and a kid, and they ran a mortgage company. And so she just like supported my drug habit with his money. And we did that for like 2 months.
Wow.
And then she's like, I need to go home and see my kid, but you can come with me. So me and her fly out to Baltimore. And now I'm in like Baltimore with this chick, like using heroin and crack, but I have no money, but she does. And then we start running out of money. And this is how I left Baltimore. The people she worked with, she asked them for $100. And they're like, yeah, meet us here. And so they stage an intervention on her and like, who the hell is this kid? Like, you have a husband, you have a kid, you have a mortgage firm. And like, who is this kid that you just are running around with? I'm like 20, 21 still.
Yeah.
And so there, and I remember this big African-American chick. And she's like, sweetheart, where did you come from? And I'm like, I'm from Salt Lake City. She's like, but where did you come from? How do you know this girl? I was like, oh, we were in rehab in Florida. And she's like, okay, well, I'm sending you back to Florida. I'm buying you a plane ticket. I'm bringing you to the airport right now, and you need to go. And I was like, okay, cool.
All right.
So she sends me back to Florida, even though I had nothing in Florida. I had nothing in Florida. So then I'm staying with a bunch of people that relapse from Florida, like the rehab drug circle, in motels and all this other crap. I convinced my mom I had a job. I convinced my mom I'm doing good. And so she is like, you can fly back home. I fly back home. She's like, God, he got me. He duped me. He's not doing good. He looks like a walking skeleton, walking track mark. And so I think I fooled her for like 2 months. And this is where the story starts to get different and better. I actually get sober. That part's coming up.
Okay,
you know?
Well, you got sober a few times throughout this.
But... yeah, a little stints, four, 2 months here at a time. And so this is where it got bad. I was in Utah. It was winter, and I'm living in a car with my buddy Chris, and we're like robbing and stealing and doing crazy stuff at this point.
It's like, got to be cold in Utah
in
winter. It's like below zero, right?
Yeah.
Freezing snow.
Yeah, it's below. Yeah, we were sleeping in a parking garage in his car. We'd have to wake up every 2 hours to turn the car back on. And one night we did, and I woke up and my knees all the way down to my feet were numb.
Wow.
Because I fell asleep with my shoes off.
Because
when you're using heroin, you're all warm and everything's fine. Then I woke up the next morning, couldn't feel my feet. Anyway, so we ended up spending the night at Chris's mom's house one night. I don't know why, but I woke up the next morning sober, kind of. And my mom said, your grandpa had a heart attack. I don't want to lose my dad and my son in the same week. It'd be really cool if you went and got some help. And she had a number for Elevate. Call this number. And I guess she like also put the number all in my clothes before I left. So I had all these numbers to Mike DePalma from Elevate in all my clothes. And it's funny when
every pocket.
Every
like,
pocket.
Okay,
yeah.
I got it.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
The last time she kicked me out, she put Mike DePalma's number in every article of clothing I had. But I was so high. I'm like, who the fuck is Mike? Like, is that the cocaine guy?
Name
you know?
Before. Why is it name in my head?
Yeah. So anyways, the miracle was that I woke up that one morning sober and got a text. My grandpa was a super important person to me. So it meant it was like scary that he just had a heart attack and might die. So I call my mom and she's crying and she's telling me everything that's going on. And I just was like, I'll go to treatment. Like I could tell the damage that I was doing to her. And I was clear headed enough to be like, I don't want to do that anymore. So anyways, that same day I fly over to Elevate. And wake up and Elevate the next morning for sober. And I'm like, what? I'm on this cabin in California. have no idea about the program, have no idea about anything. Like, that was how I made the decision. It's like, oh, I'm stressing my mom out. Like, I don't want to make things worse. I'll go to treatment so she could feel better. Like, that was, it didn't matter where I went. Elevate was just a means to an end at that exact point in my life. So I get here, and the first day I'm in detox, and I start asking the detox chick. I'm like, so, like, what are we doing? You know, like, how does this place work? Like, what is this place? What do you mean it's not 12 step? If it's not 12 step, then what is it? Like, I didn't know anything different than that. She's like, oh, well, we do mindfulness and we do groups and we do exercise. And I was like, okay, but like, what about the 12 steps? Like, what am I going to be doing? Like, who's going to be talking to me? I just didn't know.
Yeah.
But I wasn't like rude about it. I just was curious.
Yeah.
So she kind of explains it and kind of just gave me the, like, they'll explain it to you when you're done detoxing. Like, you just chill out, you know? So I detoxed, no medications.
Yeah, back then we did drug-free.
Yeah. So I wasn't bad enough. I wasn't like a seizure risk. Even though it felt like I was dying, I wasn't going to die.
Well, you were probably over detox too, since you spent the whole summer in detox every single weekend.
I was like, dude, where's the Ativan? Where's the Suboxone? Let's go. So I do detox. I do the Elevate program. I find out. I think I knew it was like a long program, but... like, not really, you know, 90-day program at that point.
Minimum.
We had a minimum. We only had a 90-day program back then. I was like, damn, okay. 90 is a long time, but I need to get my life on track. And so here's the thing. I did the 90-day program. I flew back home after thinking I was cured because Elevate was so different. The people were so different. And I thought I was just cured. I didn't think I needed to go to meetings or do anything different. I thought like Elevate cured me. Like that was literally how I felt. I felt so good. I gained 70 pounds.
Wow.
I fixed all the relationships in my life and my family. I learned some coping skills. I learned how to be with myself and be okay with myself. And
Responsibility for all your actions.
Took responsibility for my actions. Yeah. Like the girl stuff I tried to pull in my first program. They're like, no, I don't think so, dude. You know, so there was people like telling me I couldn't do these things. I couldn't do that. And I needed to like take responsibility and grow up. And essentially at Elevate, I grew up. I became an adult. Finally, I had to do chores. I had to do, you know, I had to have responsibility. I had consequences for my actions. I had to be a group on time. I couldn't have coffee in group. I couldn't smoke a cigarette whenever I wanted. And so I got G-checked by the rules here, which is the thing that I probably needed the most.
Well, and it's not like you easily fell in line.
You
fought it quite a bit. You were a bit of a problem child.
For sure.
But we're used to that. That's not like
exactly
unusual.
And I didn't really get into that too much because when I left, I ended up relapsing again, thinking that I was cured, going back to the same environment, thinking that everything was fixed. And I did nothing to hold on to the progress that I made. I was still going to the gym, but I was doing landscaping back home and those guys were drinking. So I started drinking and then the whole cycle started again. I started drinking. I'd be hungover at work. So my roommate would get me Adderall and then I'd take 2 Adderall and then 3 and then 4. And then now I'm tweaked out and now I need to come down. So then I did Xanax and then more Xanax and then alcohol, Xanax, Adderall. And then I was like, dude, let's just go back to what you know and love. Let's start doing heroin and crack again, blah, blah, blah. Catch some charges. I fell asleep getting gas at 2 in the afternoon at a gas station. Wake up to a cop knocking on my window and they arrest me, go to jail, do that whole thing, bail out, drive back home to my mom's house. On my way to my mom's house, get pulled over, get a speeding ticket. And I'm just like, dude, what is going on? You know? And my mom's like, you should go back to Elevate. You should go back to Elevate. You should go back to Elevate. And I was like, yeah, I really should. But I have this court case now. I got to stay for it. My mom's like, dude, you're going to have way more court cases if you don't go back to Elevate.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm just interjecting. It's one thing I know I don't use as a stare tactic, but we often tell people, like, once you know better, you truly know, the recourse is 1,000 times harder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you're the living example of exactly what that did. Like, in quick succession, you were getting some massive justice put in on you because you knew better at that point.
I did. Yeah, it was kind of just like, wow, man, like, here we are again.
Yeah.
So I go back to Elevate, thinking that it was just going to be like a little 30-day review, a little brush up. 90-day brush up. I do another 90-day brush up. So in 2014, I spent, I did 180 days of treatment at Elevate in 2014. And so this time I fly back September 6th, 2014. I wake up the next day, September 7th, in the cabin at Elevate in detox. But I just felt this like sense of relief because now I can reference back to my first program now that we're talking about my second. And I could say that I felt this relief. I knew the people. I knew how I felt when I was here the first time. I knew it was going to be okay. I was excited. I was like ready to get back to like that feeling that I had of almost being cured. Like that was the feeling I felt, was that like, I'm a grown up. My life is better. My life is fixed. Everything's back to normal. I can like go live my life.
Well, and there was the familiarity of all the staff still being there. Yeah. Like, oh, Dallas, welcome back. Here you are.
Everyone was excited to see me. Like, dude, what happened? You know, and all that type of stuff. And, you know, even people from my first program stayed around to start working here and train and do that whole deal. And
it's like coming home.
Yeah. So I came to Elevate the second time knowing that I needed to stay at Elevate and do the 90-day, three-month internship and become a counselor, because I thought about it my first time. But I was like, so like, I got my life back. Let's go back to my life. That the training program wasn't as intriguing, but it crossed my mind. It's like, wow, dude, like I really like this place. I really like the people. I like how they do things around here. I think I'd fit in like a glove. So going back the second time, I knew I was here to stay. I brought all my movies. I brought all my clothes. I brought everything that I owned to Elevate the second time around. So I do my 90-day program a little bit more thoroughly this time, a little bit more serious. I started to be the guy that was your roommate that would be like, hey, man, like you shouldn't do that. And this is why this is important and you should take it serious. I was like convincing people to stay in treatment as a client and like talking highly of the program and using like my screw ups as example to like mentor these newer people in the program. While also staying in my lane, though, you know, while also working on myself.
Yeah. Well, and you're still Dallas, regardless.
And I'm still me.
Yeah.
And I'm still me.
Yeah.
So I get back into the fitness and I start working out. I gained 80 pounds the second program. I came in at 148 pounds.
Oh,
and
my
gosh. When I graduated, I was 220 pounds. And I wasn't fat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't wow. Overweight.
I can't even see you at 220 in my mind.
Yeah. So that's 30 pounds more than I weigh now.
Yeah.
I was eating good. The food over here at Elevate, folks,
is
amazing.
Yeah. Well, and let's be honest, the workouts, they're pretty Globo styles. A lot of weightlifting, not a ton of cardio.
Yeah. That was before we introduced like CrossFit fully.
Yeah.
And we kind of just had a weightlifting tent. And
yes.
I'd go bench press and deadlift and curl and push up. Kind of like prison workouts type of stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, so at the end of my second program, I applied to train here because I was a shithead. My last program, they were like, we don't really know, dude. We don't really know if you're cut out for this. And I remember being like, in my mind, like, hey, dude, I don't have any other options. But also, more importantly, like, I really want to do this. I don't think you get it. And I remember the HR guy coming to be like, hey, man, like, you didn't get accepted, you know, like, sorry. And so I went up to the HR guy that's under him. Like, I got talked to by like the supervisor of HR, and I went up to this guy Derek, who worked under the HR guy, and was like, hey man, like, I don't think you guys get it. Like, I need to do this. I want to do this. Why wouldn't you want someone that wants to do this? Like, isn't that the point of this? You know, like, who's better to do this than some piece of shit kid that's turned his life around? And he was like, dude, I agree. Like, that's a good point. Like, why don't you write another letter and explain to them how badly you want to do this. And I was like, okay, I will. And so I wrote this, like, the first letter was like real campy, like, I've got so much out of the program. I really love it here. I really like to work here because it's so cool.
Like we read a thousand, you know, every
a thousand
week.
Letters. Yeah, thousand of like your letter of intent. Why you want to work here?
Yep.
They told me how to write it. The second letter, I wrote what I wanted to say.
Nice.
And I said, I'm not the type of person to roll over and die. I want this fucking job. I want to do this. I want to save lives. Like, give me a job. Like, it was like in a lot of intention, like very serious, like no bullshit. And a week later, the HR guy comes 2 days before I had to leave and was like, we're going to give you a chance, dude. And I was just like, thank God.
Yeah.
Because I was already creating other aftercare plans, which were garbage. Yeah. Like my mom was like, nope, you're not, I don't, not giving you any money. We're not doing nothing. My mom wouldn't even talk to me, by the way.
There's a lot of damage there. A
lot of damage.
The only time heals. Nothing but time heals.
Yeah, when I came here, my whole family said, don't talk to us for a whole year.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't get a year sober, we don't give a shit.
Yep.
Like, if you can't get a year sober, we're not in your life. So the staff were communicating with my mom, like, what the hell are we going to do with this kid?
Right.
And that might have been why they hired me. I don't know.
I'm a sucker for a good story. You know, I ultimately, you know, decide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when someone wants it that bad and they prove it and it's from the heart, I can overlook a lot of the stuff. And at the very least, give them a chance in the trainee period to see if they, you know, how they turn out, if they're a good fit, mm-hmm. if they're a good cultural fit and they have a good work ethic. You know,
there we go.
Why not? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you gave it the okay, Ange, because now look at us 6 years later.
Man, amazing.
Here we are. But the training program, I didn't get in trouble one time. I didn't get talked to one time.
Which is amazing.
Which is amazing. Yeah.
It can be a tough transition from, you know, being a client and now you're sort of, I don't want to say policing your friends, but you're in a different position and not a lot of people can make that transition very easily.
Yeah. And I think for me, it was so easy because I was already policing them as a client. Like, because for me, it was so serious. It was like, dude, I have nothing else to fall back on. Like I have to, like all my chips, I pushed all my chips in. You know, so I always tell clients that too. Like, if you push all your chips in and give yourself no way out, you'll probably succeed. Like, it's gotta be that serious. And Eric Thomas, he's like a motivational speaker. He always says, once you wanna be successful, as bad as you wanna breathe, you'll be successful. And that's like how I felt the second time here, where it was just like, dude, everything was just, it was like life or death, finally, for me.
That's what it takes. It's the bottom.
Yeah. And once it was that important, here we are.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my story leading up to sobriety.
I love it. And what, now you've been with us for 6 years, you've held many different positions within the organization. What do you love doing the most? I mean, I know in my mind what I think you're the best at but I want to hear from your perspective.
So what I love the most, I would say, that's hard because there has been so much over the years now. But my connection was connecting with other clients. My connection, my purpose, what felt right was helping other people.
Yep.
And so whatever avenue that was, when I first started working here, it was like crisis intervention. So I got so much experience of dealing with 60-year-old men, 60-year-old women, 20-year-old men, 20-year-old women, walking down the hill. I was always the crisis guy.
Oh, yeah. Every situation, every denomination, every possible thing you could get thrown at you. That is one of the trickiest jobs. And we had Seth on here.
Exactly, yeah.
And it takes a very special person that can adapt and pivot like on a dime and a lot of times you're going in blind.
I'm going in blind.
You're trying to get people out of the room to go to block. You're trying to get, you know, 15 miles down the road.
Not to leave, come back to treatment.
You're in the wrong shoes because you didn't realize you were going for a long walk today.
Yeah.
There's a lot you got to endure in that.
Yeah, you're wearing a sweatshirt going on a 15 mile hike in 80 degree weather, but you're doing it to help, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that was my favorite thing was seeing that it was working. Like, obviously, helping people was the idea and helping people was the message. And I really cared and I still do really care. I knew I was passionate about it. And I felt like I cared more than the average person in that I would see good results from that. Like, from really caring about these people and their experience here. And also being like a total product of the program. Like, my experience is that if you do this program, it works. So being able to convey that message and relay that message to people through my experience, that was the most helpful part.
Well, and you just have 100% certainty that if you do it right and you apply these steps, you will be sober.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that was my favorite part. And then growing from that, being like the crisis intervention guy, I became a pretty damn good counselor.
Absolutely.
Because of the vast experience in 3 years of dealing with it that I had to do. So I think I got certified as a counselor like 2.5 years in. You need, 2 years of experience and schooling and all hours, that stuff. Yep. And so I did all like the clinical supervised hours here and then got credentialed as a KDAC and then started moving in more to like a one-on-one counseling role. And from there, one-on-one counseling to my own one-on-one kind of department, like specialized counseling with me and Miles, who one day will probably get on the podcast and, maybe talk LIC or something in depth.
And, that'd be great, yeah.
And then the CrossFit stuff. CrossFit came up probably a year and a half, 2 years ago, for me at least, as an opportunity. We lost our CrossFit coach and...
Yeah, like, and we moved the gym on property finally, yeah. And it was just kind of like right in your backyard. How do you not do it?
yeah.
It's as convenient as you could possibly be, and it was free.
Yeah, and it was free, yeah. So I went and got certified as a CrossFit coach, and so now I get to help people mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically all in one day. And that's why it was hard to answer your question about what do you love the most, because I love what I do now the most. Like the combination of helping someone rebuild trust with their family and then teach them how to squat properly and how to stretch. And then I see like, dude, my family's so proud of me and I'm so proud of me. It's just like this feeling you can't really describe.
Yeah.
But you know it because you've had those same feelings.
That's why I stay intimately involved in everything. I like being on the ground floor and seeing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I don't know, Ange, maybe we could kind of pivot from here, but that was essentially the lead up to Elevate, what Elevate's done for me, briefly kind of where I am now, 6 years sober with my own place and a great relationship and, counseling my family members now that do talk to me. And
yeah, you've definitely flipped the roles on that.
We flipped the roles on that. Yeah, I've gotten, people related to me into the program. And I think in the 6 years, I've gotten like 8 or 9 people here personally.
Exactly.
I'm a huge, advocate. Yeah, for Elevate, for recovery. And that's just that this is my life now, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Well, and let's talk about how far you've come. Where did you just spend your vacation?
In Cabo San Lucas.
With
my girlfriend, with my family.
Your dad?
And with everybody. With everyone I love, dude. In Cabo San Lucas for my 6 years sober.
Exactly. That's what I loved seeing that little Instagram thing. Mm-hmm. You had a sober 6 year pinata.
I did. And it was a beer can.
Is that what that was?
It was a beer can.
Is it a firecracker? Like, what is it? No, it was
a Pacifico Light beer.
Nice.
And I beat the shit out of it with a tennis racket.
Yeah. You should have had the bat though, boy. That tennis racket did not give it the explosion I was hoping
for. It didn't. And there was no surface area, so it like sliced the air. It was if you're ever using a pinata, don't use a tennis racket.
Definitely not the weapon of choice.
Yeah.
You should have used a golf club.
I should have, but I didn't have my golf clubs. I had to rent my golf clubs.
Well, I'll tell you, Dal, you want to pivot. One of the things that I absolutely positively love about you is the cultural fit. I myself am always trying to get people interested in things and excited about things and, looking out for our staff and building our culture. And for me, you 100% represent our culture or 100% of what I want our culture to be like, because you truly embrace fun and sobriety and it shows and you're proud of it. And you're just the living example of, being sober doesn't have to be a somber and miserable thing.
Right.
Like being sober, you're just even more you to enjoy more you stuff.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. And you're like great morale. Like I know if I'm going to, announce something to the staff, I'm going to look to you and you're going to be 100% supportive in whatever it is. And not that you're a yes man, because that's definitely not the case. We're just like-minded and you see the bigger picture or the value or the message. And I always appreciate the heck out of that from you.
Well, thank you, Ange. Yeah, well, I'm usually excited to hear the updates, I'm like, all right, cool. I'm just like happy.
Even
to
the
be...
policies of the week. You're excited about those, where everyone else is like, ugh, policy
I'm like,
of
no,
the
this
week.
Shit's important. This shit's important,
Yeah.
That's just, I don't know. I think I appreciate you saying that, but I think it just stems from gratitude. From like all the listeners, like, dude, my life sucked. I hated myself. I hated where I was at. And I don't now. So I don't have any reason to be miserable or like unenthusiastic. I love what I do. I love the place that I work. I love the people I work with, and I love the clients that I am there for. So it's kind of like I'm living the perfect version of life, and it feels so good. So I'm able to bring that to work because it's just authentic. It's genuine. It's how I feel. It's just me. Like you said, I get to be more me today. And being me doesn't suck.
It doesn't suck at all. And you're just an amazing example. And I think a lot of people try to model themselves after you because you 100% walk the walk, live the walk, and you're something to strive for because your history is so bad, you know, and seeing where you are today, like every person wants that kind of like change in their life.
They do. Yeah. And it's cool because you can use your, you know, your shitty experiences to create the change for them. You know, it's like they always say change. Once you believe change is possible, then you just have to kind of stay motivated to change. So I kind of try to be like the, like change is possible, like believer person, you know, like, dude, you guys can all change. I know you don't see it, but it's possible. And all of us are living examples of that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
The context is just a little bit different for each of us individually. But to some degree, all of our lives sucked and we all made a great change and all of our lives are a lot better now for a lot of similar skills and reasons.
For sure. Well, and I think another part of why you're so successful is because you're not like, I did the program, now I'm fixed and I'm better. Mm-hmm. You continue to strive and look for things to keep enhancing, you know, your sobriety, your knowledge, your skills. Like you're on a constant and perpetual quest for self-betterment. It's not like you just did it and you're great now. You're constantly trying to get better and better and better. And I think, you know, for those of us that have been in this field for a long time, that's vital.
Exactly.
You know, it has to be more than just a job. We can't just be like, oh, I'm good. It's like, we got to keep getting better because life changes and new things come up and there's just so much out there and to learn and keep growing with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that started, like, I learned that here, you know, like, okay, like if my life is this good now, how could it be in a year and how can I learn more? And I think it started too from, I hated not having the answers for somebody. I hated not being able to help. So if I failed miserably somewhere, right? Like say I talked to a 70-year-old female and she's like, what do you know? You're 23-year-old male heroin addict. I'm 70 years old and I drink alcohol. What the hell do you know about me? There's so many of those experiences where I'm like, okay, let's go back to the drawing board. Let's readjust. How do we approach them? Yeah. I'm going to bring up MASH, you know, or like something, like whatever I'm going to go knit with her, build rapport, bring her walls down and then, you know, try and help her or whatever it was. But what was I going to say? I was going to respond to the self-improvement, the self-betterment. And I learned that here, right? I learned that at Elevate and that everything I have in my life right now is because I got sober. So I always like double down on the sobriety and the growth and the recovery and just try to become better.
Absolutely.
Because it's been working for me and I'm not gonna stop now.
Yeah. Well, and we should never stop. I mean, that's our lives. It should be a lifelong learning process for sure.
Yeah, and it is. And I also don't think just, you know, kind of as we're probably winding down here, I don't use work as my recovery. I don't say, oh man, I listened to a bunch of, you know, people, clients struggling with addiction for 8 hours. I don't count that as my own recovery. So I think that's been a super big takeaway for me. And I've been able to kind of communicate that to other staff members where I'm like, hey, showing up here is not recovery, it's a job. Like you wouldn't go to Walmart and be like, oh, I clocked in for 8 hours. Like I don't need to go to meetings now, you know, or I don't need to meditate or read or see a therapist or a counselor or learn a new skill or whatever your recovery looks like. So that's been my biggest takeaway too, is that Elevate is a place where I can recover at, but it isn't my personal recovery. It's a big part of it, but it's not everything.
I love that. And you're right. We see so much of that, especially with newer staff where they feel like, well, I work so much, you know, this is my recovery. It's like, no, there's a wheel of life for a reason because you have to like fill all those wheels.
Yeah.
Like, and what it's did easy you do to for go yourself? All in on your job and say, I'm good, but that's not going to keep you in a balanced state.
Exactly. No, yeah, that's exactly it. So yeah, Ange, I think that is the story, the general gist of it. Dal was a bad kid.
I love it. I've never heard the in detail version that I heard today, and I absolutely love it.
Well, thanks, Ange. I'm glad it wasn't too hard on the ears. Oh. I left a lot out, a lot of stuff that would probably, you know, haunt me forever.
Yeah, we only got an hour. I mean, there's only so much we can get in here. Plus, you know, we've got this podcast for eternity.
I'm
sure we're going to be seeping lots of stuff out over the next forever.
We will. And I had to deliver kind of a PG-13 version, too.
Absolutely.
There's definitely a rated R version out there. It's not out there,
I was like, oh, really?
But no, there's not a rated
R. Please tell me there's no... Yeah,
I meant like, it was rated R.
Gotcha.
My life, you know?
Well, most junkies are alcoholics. Yeah, there is definitely not the PG version.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of, this is usually the point in the show where we let our guests plug their stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a part of why you and I started podcasting is because you've already been doing a podcast for a while. So why don't you give us a plug and tell us about that so our listeners can head on over and get more of you.
Yeah. Okay. So I started doing a podcast with a great buddy of mine, Jeremy Miller. He's been in recovery for 11 plus years, and we wanted to make a podcast that was recovery based, but we found ourselves helping like our friends outside of work. We found ourselves helping our family, and we kind of became those go-to guys for advice or problems, you know, like your friend circle is like, hey man, like I'm fighting with my girlfriend. I wanted to kind of get some coffee with you and run it by you. Like we just kind of became those guys. So we wanted to do that on a bigger scale. We wanted to help more people. So we have a podcast called The Betterment Bros. It's Jeremy and I, and we field questions from our audience and try to shoot advice, and we do topics and special guests, a lot like this too. But it's not only recovery. It is a little bit broader than that, and we talk a lot of ideas and concepts and topics, and it's evolved throughout the years, but you can find us on Apple Podcast at The Betterment Bros. You can find us on social media at Betterment Bros, at Betterment Bros. And you can write us emails at betterment bros@gmail.com. And
those
we'll get
are the
back
best because you can literally ask anything and watch them sort of squirm and how they're going to answer it.
Yeah.
You know, the funnier, the wilder, the more out there, the better, because they'll just handle it head on. It's amazing.
And that's a great point too. I'm not under the work umbrella, so it tends to be a little bit more looser. And, you know, I think we've had a couple topics on there that are, you know, like abortion. We've had like some pretty like cutting edge, like deep conversations that I wouldn't have under this umbrella of Elevate.
Right. Yeah. You have that freedom to go wherever you want.
Right. Yeah. But I guess, yeah. So you don't need to find me on my personal Instagram. There's nothing crazy there. Just pictures of my girlfriend and my dog. But the Betterment Bros is where you want to find me and Jeremy at.
There's a lot of working out.
There's a lot of working out too.
As there should be.
Yeah. But you should also follow the Elevate Addiction Service podcast as well.
Right.
At
the Elevate Experience.
I meant Instagram. Oh. You should follow the Elevate Addiction Service Instagram. But you guys should already be following by this point the Elevate Experience. And if you're not, you should look into that.
Perfect.
Yeah, sounds I'm just good. Rambling at this point.
Yeah,
come find
lunchtime.
Us. We're
We've
everywhere.
We've got book club in like 10 minutes. You got to
eat.
Oh,
shit, we do have book club
in
10 minutes.
Yeah, we got stuff to do.
Okay. Also, Read the Road, Less Traveled. Great book.
There you go.
Ange, thanks for listening to all my failures and listening and being
and
here
triumphs.
For all my successes.
I love it. Yeah, thanks for being here, Dal. Thanks for being open with us.
Yeah. All right, guys, that's our show for today. We hope you found some value from listening. And if you did, please share with someone you know or love. You can find us on social media. We are at Elevate Addiction Services.
And if you or a loved one are struggling with addiction, please call our toll-free, confidential 24-hour helpline at 833-33-SOBER or visit our website at elevaterehab.org.